This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome, everyone, to the last lecture in our 2011 Comparative Ethnic Studies series. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Sharon Holland unsettles. In the foreword to Black Queer Studies, she writes, quote, home is a four-letter word, and the practice of Black queer, Q-U-A-R-E, studies embodies all of its double meanings, end quote. Sharon Holland's work dislocates the home tied to African American studies, Native American studies, Black feminist studies, and queer studies. She unsettles. In Crossing Waters, Crossing Worlds, the African diaspora in Indian country, she begins the text with a new travel narrative to, quote, a place where the Indian and the African haunt the edges of colonial history and herstory. She unsettles. In Raising the Dead, readings of death and Black subjectivity, as she explains her use of Toni Morrison's Unspeakable Things Unspoken, she reminds us, quote, that ultimately Morrison called for critics to transgress boundaries, to undertake a type of travel that necessitated another kind of understanding, that retrieving both literature and imaginary subjects from a space that is simultaneously spiteful, loud, and quiet is necessary and dangerous work. She unsettles. Her necessary and dangerous work has led to the forthcoming book, The Erotic Life of Racism. This forthcoming study analyzes the last decade of humanities scholarship on race. We who have had the pleasure of reading parts of The Erotic Life of Racism eagerly await this necessary and dangerous work that unsettles Black feminist theory, critical race theory, and queer theory. She writes, quote, what aspects of feminist thought, especially Black feminist thought, had to be eliminated in order for the erotic life of queer theory to become legible? The Erotic Life of Racism redirects our attention to desire so that it is no longer free of racism. These are still her words, not mine, but rather embedded within it. So that when we think of our erotic life, we are always already thinking about a racialized territory. She makes the legible legible. She unsettles. Sharon Holland's works include Raising the Dead, Readings of Death and Black Subjectivity, 2000, which won the Laura Romero First Book Prize from the American Studies Association, and the co-authored volume, Crossing Waters, Crossing Worlds, The African Diaspora in Indian Country, 2006. The Erotic Life of Racism is forthcoming from Duke University Press. She is professor of English, African and African American Studies, and Women's Studies at Duke University. It is my pleasure to welcome Sharon Holland.
An incredible introduction. I'm honored, and I hope I can just live up to at least half of it this afternoon. Thank you for coming out on what is a gorgeous day. I'm sure we'd all better be in the quad, so I'll try to be as brief but hopefully entertaining as I can be. This paper that I'm going to give today is just basically like entirely speculative in so many ways, and it covers the beginnings of the next book project that I'm working on that's loosely entitled, well, the real title is just Perishment. And I have a subtitle, I'm not sure I'm all that happy about it. So anyway, the title here is Human, Animal, Black, Indian. I have two epigraphs. The animal looks at us, and we are naked before it. Thinking, perhaps, begins there. Jacques Derrida, the animal that therefore I am. Second epigraph. Where else but in this disorganized world would such an encounter be possible? Toni Morrison, A Mercy. First section, Nemesis. In the revised and expanded edition of The Dreaded Comparison, Human and Animal Slavery, originally published in 1988, and about which Alice Walker said, and I quote, "This powerful book will take a lifetime to forget." Not sure if that was really faint praise or not, but Marjorie Spiegel begins to bear a series of always awful and sometimes artful proofs about the relationship. Is this echoing a lot? Sounds echoey to me. You can hear me? Okay, just want to make sure. Sometimes artful proofs about the relationship between the suffering, think Bentham, 1789, think Levinas. At one point in her critique, Spiegel turns herself to the literary and Sterling L. Brown's 1968 essay, Negro Character as Seen by White Authors. While noting the post-emancipation shift in the attitude of whites toward their black counterparts, Brown uses the image of, quote, the docile mastiff turned rabid mad dog to draw readers' attention to the stereotyping of blackness as bestial. Spiegel then observes that, quote, in seeing comparisons of blacks to animals that were so prevalent in the period literature of his study, Brown accepted and, through his response, subsequently strengthened the negative views about animals held by racist authors. Brown's indignation at these offensive books blinded him to the fellow victims of their propaganda, end quote. Spiegel's assessment pulls in two directions. The first is more obvious, that stereotypes of animals are universally held. The second is more opaque, that blackness's normative gaze upon the animal therefore prohibits ethical relation. And an encounter with the animal, enslaved experience can justify dropping the bottom out of the question of blackness's ethical commitment to the animal other, put another way. This is a fundamental problem to which I will return. In the course of her examination of animal and human suffering, and this is an important detail because no moment of comparison in the book opens the possibility of shared pleasure, only pain, she makes the obligatory nod toward the condition and sentiment of the Native American. Spiegel writes in a chapter on hunting, and I quote, "Notably, traditional culturally intact Native Americans and many other Aboriginal peoples hunted out of real necessity, with respect for and in harmony with the balance of nature. Theirs was not a profane act, nor an unconscious attempt to symbolically conquer chaos. Harmony and respect were central to an entire worldview, a view of the universe with which the very lives of Native Americans were imbued. From birth until death, and in their philosophy, from death until rebirth," end quote. Now that's a mouthful. This type of conceptualization of Indian life is not uncommon, and Phil DeLoria painstakingly documents how we as an American culture arrived at such overwhelming and overarching collective sentiment about Native Americans in his important book, Playing Indian. What I am interested in for the purposes of this talk and for the aims of my larger project called tentatively Perishment, Thoughts at the Interstice of the Human-Animal Distinction, is not how or why we arrived at our conclusions about blacks and Indians' relationship to the animal, but rather how we might think through these historicized entanglements. I say historicized because views of Indian life and animals are sedimented in a kind of archaic, to borrow from DeLoria, historicization of an Indian time before settler colonialism. Views of black life and animals solidified during slavery, as Spiegel's book relentlessly catalogs. What is interesting about Spiegel's front-loading of negative black relation to the animal via Brown's work is that she ends her observations with several quotes in support of her comparative argument. Three of these are pulled from Frederick Douglass and the most famous African-American vegetarian, Dick Gregory. Then he became a fruitarian, I think, for a while, and then moved back to vegetarianism. It's not funny. It's not funny. In particular, the first quote from Douglass's narrative is, and I quote, "There is no denying that slavery had a direct and positive tendency to produce coarseness and brutality in the treatment of animals, especially those most useful to agricultural industry. Not only the slave, but the horse, the ox, and the mule share the general feeling of indifference to the right naturally engendered by the state of slavery. The master blamed the overseer the slave, and the slave the horses, oxen, and mules. And violence fell upon the animals as a consequence," end quote. The nagging question I have is why Spiegel doesn't use their work as evidentiary claim for her argument. Why front load a lack of ethical connection when the literature might tell us otherwise? In the comparative framework I am drawing here, black relation to the animal is rendered as a blind spot, impossible because of the machinations of slavery. Indian relation to the animal is naturalized as part of a cultural matrix, universalized to the point of becoming the great Indian chain of being. To push this argument a little further, I do want to note that I am purposely picking on Spiegel, but my nudging is intentional here, as I believe there is something to be gained from thinking through this opposition between Indian and Black, among Indian, Black, and non-human animal. Years ago, I wrote an article about Afro-Native literature and the importance of thinking through issues of sovereignty and emancipation. I now pick up the loose thread of that argument in order to think through the relationship of these stereotypical views of Black-Indian relation to the non-human animal. In the literature, at least, it seems as if freedom and self-determination are tasks that Indian and Black peoples are not up to accomplishing on their own. Moreover, I want to also note that this fitness for self-government is dependent upon, not upon the relations among humans per se, but mired in one's relationship to the non-human animal, making the present-day question of the animal absolutely important to the articulation of aspects of sovereignty and freedom constitutive of Indian and Black life, respectively. Taking one more glance at Spiegel, in the same chapter on hunting, where she gives praise, specious though it might be, to Indian life ways, she also states rather offhandedly, quote, "Hunters may pay up to $50,000 to legally kill an endangered polar bear in Canada, purchasing a hunting license from a Native American tribe that peddles them for cash," end quote. So much for the peace, love, and coconuts argument about Native culture, which ends the chapter. Here, the beautiful fiction of Indian essence comes smack in the face of the issue of sovereignty. When it comes time to self-determine, the indigenous body is a mere peddler, a black market capitalist, end quote. I mean, that's not end quote, I actually said that. So too, this is what happens when you're too proud to get those bifocals, you know? So too does black life falter in the wake of emancipation, as Spiegel quotes Brown's opinion that, in freedom, they are beasts, end quote. The twin images of the sovereign and the beast are brought to bear here in a stunning kaleidoscopic interplay. This arc resonates with my larger fourth book project, The Perishment Project, as I endeavor to expose a global conversation about sovereignty and biopower to intellectual work in Native studies that should inform it. For the purposes of today's lecture, I hope to understand this connection among Black, Indian, and non-human animal as it is drawn in Toni Morrison's A Mercy. How many readers here of A Mercy? Okay. A peculiar, pithy, but dense homage to relationships among peoples in the fledgling nation, circa 1690. But first, a bit on sovereignty and freedom. After the 1871 congressional decision to suspend treaty-making practices with indigenous peoples, the United States entered into a colonial power relationship with them, at least in the eyes of Kevin Brunell's The Third Space of Sovereignty. In the period between 1871 and the political movements of the 60s that brought forth moments like the American Indian Chicago Conference, this colonial relationship devolved, to put it mildly. Thinking through both Phil DeLaurier and Brunell's arguments about the necessary mythic disappearance of the Indian into an archaic past, I am intrigued by how this naturalizing of Indian being through issues of non-sovereign rule can be understood alongside self-determination and emancipation, also as a node which returns the Indian and Black other to a deteriorizing natural state, to a beast who cannot be governed by itself or others. In Jacques Derrida's famed first volume of his last series of lectures, The Beast and the Sovereign, he notes, and I quote here again, "Here, whenever we speak of the beast and the sovereign, we shall have in view an analogy between two current representations, current and therefore problematical, suspect to be interrogated. Between this type of animality or living being that is called the beast, or that is represented as bestiality, on the one hand, and on the other, a sovereignty that is most often represented as human or divine, in truth, anthropo-theological," end quote. Thus, the condition of sovereignty is weighted heavily in the direction of the non-human animal, or that of Derrida, a type of animality, making ideas of animal being intrinsically bound to the ability of the sovereign to self-determine not only his or her own fate, but that of others. Derrida paints the landscape of interaction between beast and sovereign with the stuff of fairy tales, the big bad wolf, among others, demonstrating that the archaic, or the no longer efficient, is also in play during this scripted interaction. To solidify what I mean by this archaic past that I also mentioned earlier, I turn to Brunel's apt description of the catch-22 that Native peoples find themselves in relation to what he terms, and this is perhaps another mouthful, the modern American liberal democratic settler state. End quote. In Brunel's assessment of the Mille Lacs Band's response to then-Wisconsin Governor Jesse Ventura's challenge to Native sovereignty, he notes, and I quote, there are two prevalent American sentiments about indigenous peoples' political status. The first sentiment is that indigenous tribes and nations claim a form of sovereignty that is unclear because it is not easily located inside or outside of the United States. The spatial logic is quite simple. The tribe is part of the United States. It is not sovereign, but if it is to be sovereign, it cannot be part of and thus make demands on the United States. The second sentiment is that the treaty secured rights of indigenous tribes stem from an archaic political time that cannot assume a modern form. In sum, Chippewa sovereignty is not permitted to develop into a modern form and engage in practices commensurate with present-day American political life, end quote. Assessments of what black freedom at the time of emancipation and beyond would look like travel along the lines of the racist to the truly celebratory. While the state of black persons in the U.S. is neither colonial nor post-colonial, this neither nor boundary, this inability for blackness to settle into its progress, is reflective of the same states of injury and redress outlined by post-colonial theorists. In many ways, once formal campaigns to repatriate blacks to Liberia, for example, ceased, the back body, like its Indian counterpart circa 1871, was cast in a web of constant attempts at domestication. No longer what Brunel calls a foreign concern, Indianness, and I would add blackness here as well, became a domestic problem to be solved through attempts at veritable eradication. But present life demonstrates the absolute failure of this effort to domesticate. I want to turn now to Morrison's Of Mercy to demonstrate ways in which this attempt to answer the question of black freedom and Indian sovereignty, to how the novel clears the way for ways in which this attempt to answer the question of black freedom and Indian sovereignty is managed by Morrison in the negative. I also want to draw our attention to how the novel clears the way for such domesticating through the figure of the non-human animal and human association with it. Next section is entitled Of Beasts and Sovereigns. Just realized I don't have the time. You have the time, Sam?
4:56.
4:56? Okay. Thank you. We are a nation obsessed with origins. If one were to listen to the hue and cry from distant quarters of this country's Tea Party revolutionaries, we would think that our origins certainly do not reflect the diversity of persons who pepper this small portion of the globe we call home. In A Mercy, the notion of origin is always already that, a notion usually vague and unimpressive as a foundational idea of something. When we wish in our present tense for how things were, we reset the clock on the past, populate it with those whom we imagine, reflect our core values as a nation, and then repackage that thing called history for more popular consumption. Nothing is so black and white as our ideas about history when we get down to the business of hating one another. Anyone who wants to get back to that mythical and happy nation that our founding fathers authored hasn't had the pleasure of reading the tedious diary entries of Cotton and Increase Mather, or delighted in the musing of one Michael Withersworth, or contemplated Thomas Jefferson's more self-reflexive chapter called Manners in Notes on the State of Virginia on the devastating havoc that centuries of slavery can wreak upon kin, home, and ultimately nation, or venture to read William Apis's stunning manifesto, or had a look at David Walker's appeal. When we start to have conversations about who belongs where and why, where and when and why, I am reminded that except for certain tender mercies like acts of friendship, salvation, and sustenance, none of us do belong. Diversity in this nation is not new. In fact, it is plainly put, a mercy. If a mercy can be understood to encompass all the acts between human beings that comprise the nature of diversity itself, in these times, our very biodiversity is dependent upon a mercy. Acts of acknowledgement, kindness, and bravery pull human being from the arc of hatred and isolation into the bandwidth of compassion and consideration of the other. Those same acts, in turn, must also pull non-human animal being from the brink of extinction. A mercy, according to the OED, can be a blessing or a relief. In many ways, a mercy is an ethical commitment. In his brief essay on the name The Dog, or Natural Rights, there goes that dog again, right? From Difficult Freedom, Emmanuel Levinas observes, and I quote again, "With the appearance of the human, and this is my entire philosophy, there is something more than my life, and that is the life of the other," end quote. In the Cartesian tradition that Levinas follows, it is important that the animal is distinct from the human. For some philosophers, this difference is speech. For Levinas, it is the face. The face holds the possibility for recognition, for exchange, for mercy. Animals are thought to be incapable of such reciprocal looking, hence the beginning of the talk in Jacques Derrida's Standing Before the Animal, Naked, Gazing Upon You. In her astute review of the novel, that is, A Mercy, New York University scholar Elizabeth McHenry writes that the book is, quote, "a story about a world in which acts of mercy prove ambiguous, and the lines between cruelty and compassion are murky at best," end quote. Indeed, somewhere between the ambiguous and the murky, cruelty and compassion, the ethical commitment floats, awaiting our attention, our action. A Mercy, this is a really bad summary, so I apologize, but you know, Morrison's, I wrote a much longer one, and then that was like 4 pages, so I thought, I'm just gonna give you the really bad Cliff Note version, and then we can talk a little bit more about, obviously, what's missing here. A Mercy tells a story of Florence, Lena, Sorrow, and Jacob and Rebecca Vark. On a small but steadily growing farm in Virginia, Jacob, an orphan himself, hailing from Amsterdam, acquires Florence and Sorrow, both abandoned and in need of a home. I will examine at some length a scene in the novel that describes how Florence comes to live on the Varick farm later. But the central action of the novel revolves around Florence's sexual obsession with and journey to find the blacksmith who has knowledge of healing herbs that might bring Rebecca Varick back from the brink of a smallpox death. The opening of the novel is decidedly animal. Florence is the first character we meet, and in classic Morrison fashion, she comes to us out of the ether in the middle of recounting a difficult experience and enjoying our ability as readers to be shocked into the time of the novel. Morrison writes, "Don't be afraid. My telling can't hurt you in spite of what I have done, and I promise to lie quietly in the dark. I will never again unfold my limbs to rise up and bare teeth. I explain. You can think what I tell you a confession if you like, but one full of curiosity is familiar only in dreams and during those moments when a dog's profile plays in the steam of a kettle." End quote. There goes that dog again, and the madness of teeth bared, limbs unfolding. In the classic definition of bared, the process is not a revelation but an unconcealment, the removal of a covering from something. This is no secret being exposed. This act is making known what is always already there. Think Heidegger here. Think Agamben. Think, too, precarious life of some sort or other. I want to leave Florin's opening statement for other moments in the novel where this attachment to the animal is reiterated and becomes central to the novel's metaphorical landscape. The indigenous character in A Mercy and the oldest of the three indentured women on the farm, and there's arguments about whether it's indentured, whether they're indentured servants or whether they're slaves, enslaved peoples, and we can talk about that a little bit if you'd like. And the oldest of the three indentured women on the farm, Lena, quote, had been purchased outright and deliberately. In the only chapter dedicated to her story, Lena worries about the festive mood that overtakes the farm at the building of Jacob Varick's, quote, double-storied, fenced, and gated house, like the one he saw in his travels, end quote. In true Thomas Sutpen form, Varick sets to making his design come to fruition. Lena notes only, quote, "killing trees in that number without asking their permission, of course, his efforts would stir up malfortune," end quote. This is the first indication we get that Lena is different from Sorrow and Florence, the two orphan girls that Varick rescues one at a time. I will return to Lena's relationship with nature in a bit, but I want to remark upon how Morrison positions Lena to literally read the threat that black freedom poses to the territory and eventually the farm that they all inhabit. Upon meeting the unnamed blacksmith hired to work on the gates to Varick's mansion, Lena recounts, and I quote again, "learning from mistress that he was a free man doubled her anxiety. He had rights then and privileges, like sir. He could marry, own things, travel, sell his own labor. She should have seen the danger immediately because his arrogance was clear. When Mistress returned, rubbing her hands on her apron, he removed his hat once more, then did something Lena had never seen an African do. He looked directly at Mistress, lowering his glance, for he was very tall, never blinking those eyes slanted and yellow as a ram's. Again, it is the animal who lets us know the human's condition. Contemplating the blacksmith's relative freedom, Lena tells us, quote, "In the town she had been taken to after the conflagration had wiped away her village, that kind of boldness from any African was legitimate cause for a whip." And remember, it's for a whip, not a whipping. So I'm very much interested in the idea of the presence of the whip itself as prohibiting certain behaviors as opposed to the actual act. And there's moments like that in this novel that are bothersome to me, though attractive. It is interesting that we find out about Lena's peoplelessness at the precise moment that she describes punishment for an exercise of free will, or because we are talking about a gaze here, punishment for the face-to-face practice of ethical commitment to the other. Morrison has Lena not only repudiate this commitment in racialized terms, but also states her relationship to such commitment as a kind of homelessness. I would like to argue that this state of dispossession, if possession marks the free, as in the paragraph above, unmakes Lena's relationship to sovereignty. She becomes a character for us in the midst of making her own kinless state while referring to potential punishment for a simple act of practiced belonging, the face-to-face, eye-to-eye of the blacksmith and the mistress. Unlike Florence and the blacksmith, Lena is tortured by the animal. As just a few pages from the scene above, she tells us of the disease that took her family and all the others. Norrison writes, and I quote again, "At first they fought off the crows, she and two young boys, but they were no match for the birds or the smell, and when the wolves arrived, all three scrambled as high into a beech tree as they could. They stayed there all night, listening to gnawing, baying, growling, fighting, and worst of all, the quiet of animals sated at last." In many ways, end quote, in many ways, the novel is about the awful quiet of animals, human and non-human, sated at last. Remaking herself with a bricolage of conquest in the Americas, relying on memories, quote again, and her own resources, she cobbled together neglected rites, merged Europe medicine with native, scripture with lore, and recalled or invented the hidden meanings of things, found, in other words, a way to be in the world. She called with birds, chatted with plants, spoke to squirrels, sang to the cow, and opened her mouth to rain, end quote. A New World Temple Grandin, she becomes a quintessential American by being dispossessed of the narrative of her past. In her state of relative cultural collapse, she turns to the animal and communicates. Such communication does not signal meaning-making so much as it signals a becoming animal that serves as a rationale for the novel's treatment of Lena as a medium. And I'm not saying here that pieces of what Morrison is narrativizing didn't happen in some way, shape, or form. I'm interested in how that happening is juxtaposed with all the other characters in the novel and might open up another territory for investigation for us as critics. Whenever we move back in the past, the world becomes thick with non-human animals. Moreover, the unwarring of Lena and her subsequent New World remaking prepares her for the following, at least according to Sorrow, and I quote again, "that Lena ruled and decided everything Sir and Mistress did not. Her eye was everywhere, even when she was nowhere," end quote. For Sorrow, Lena is the king of kings, the doer, the decider, as she has the power to take the first, but not the second child of Sorrow, and abandon it to float down the waters of a nearby creek. The possibility of becoming sovereign, in that kind of Derridean way, couched in the most restrictive terms, where the beasts around are tamed, and power over life and death is in full exercise. Last section, ethical lessons. I want to travel through the second brief section of the novel under the umbrella term of mercy and think through some of the novel's challenges to what I am thinking of as the ethical commitment. I will start with Jacob's rescue of the raccoon. In many ways, this scene is the first human act of the story, but it also involves an animal and demonstrates the ways in which saving the animal is always at the threshold of saving, rescuing human being, and sometimes from itself. Morrison writes, "Jacob urged the mare to a faster pace. He dismounted twice, the second time to free the bloody hind leg of a young raccoon struck in a tree break. Regina, the horse, munched trailside grass while he tried to be as gentle as possible, avoiding the claws and teeth of the frightened animal. Once he succeeded, the raccoon limped off, perhaps through the mother forced to abandon it, or more likely, into other claws. End quote. Between two animals, the mare and the raccoon, and two iterations of claw, one belonging to the raccoon and the other to an unknown predator, Jacob commits his first act of mercy. It is 1682, and he is traveling via the Lenape Trail on his way to a plantation called Jublio, owned by a man named De Ortega in Maryland. The act of dislodging the injured raccoon is meant to tell us who Jacob Varick is. The work with the animal is meant to steer us into future work with the human. And it does, as his second act, the taking of the girl Florens in exchange for an unpaid debt, appears to be a mercy of signature meaning. Yet we find that all acts of kindness, as in the case of the raccoon, that one could argue, is freed for death, are not always ethical acts. If the ethical commitment of the human is to the other, something more than my life, then what if Jacob's face-to-face commitment to Florens, the girl child Florens given to Jacob by the broke plantation owner in Maryland? We learn at the end of the novel that a mercy is this solitary act. All of the others in the novel are just reverberations of the same, like a ripple on a pond. Morrison provides some answer to the conundrum of this second act of mercy in Jacob Varick's attitude toward trading in human cargo. As Jacob notes, flesh was not his commodity. But we are introduced to Jacob's disdain for slave trading not because of his absolute abhorrence of the thing itself, the trade in flesh, but because of the people with whom he associates such trade. He sees Maryland as a Palatinate state that was Romanish to the core, quote, end quote. I mean, I'm quoting here. Priests strode openly in his towns, their temples menaced its squares, their sinister missions cropped up at the edge of native villages. Law, courts, and trade were the exclusive domain, and overdressed women in raised heels rode in carts driven by 10-year-old Negroes. He was offended by the lax, flashy cunning of the Papists. Jacob is not repulsed by slavery, so much as he is unnerved by Catholicism. There was something beyond Catholic in De Ortega, something sordid and overripe, says Jacob. We have more descriptions of De Ortega and his plantation's inhabitants, a sloven man, their narrow grasp on the English language, the foolish and comprehensible talk, and curdled, arrogant fop. It is here that Morrison sets attention in the novel on religious difference rather than racial difference, and I would also add, in gendered difference. If the opening scene of Varick's travel south holds open the possibility of his interspecies compassionate practice, the scene between human beings in the first section arrests us is between Jacob and Florence's mother, the woman we will eventually come to know through her own brief narrative at the novel's close. Morrison writes, and it's a rather long quote, "Please, senor, not me. Take her. Take my daughter." Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, "God help me if this is not the most wretched business." "Why, yes, of course," De Ortega, shaking off his earlier embarrassment, trying to reestablish his dignity. "I'll sell her to you, immediately." His eyes widened, as did his condescending smile, though he still seemed highly agitated. "My answer is firm," said Jacob, thinking, "I've got to get away from this substitute for a man." But thinking also, perhaps Rebecca would welcome a child around the place. This one here, swimming in horrible shoes, appeared to be about the same age as Patrician. And if she got kicked in the head by a mare, the loss would not rock Rebecca so. "There's a priest here," De Ortega went on. "He can bring her to you. I'll have them board a sloop to any port on the coast you desire." "No," I said, "no." Suddenly the woman, smelling of clothes, knelt and closed her eyes. They wrote new papers. End quote. But what brings Varick to this end? I would like to offer that the differences here could all be parsed through the article that moves us forward through acts of mercy throughout the text. Instead of the mercy, where the refers to something known to the listener, we have a mercy, an act more unknown and unspecified. What brings Jacob face to face with the mother about to give up her child is a turning point in the tension between Varak and Deortega. Quote again, Jacob raised his eyes to Deortega, noticing the cowardice of unarmed gentry confronted with a commoner. Out here in the wilderness, dependent upon paid guards nowhere in sight this Sunday, he felt like laughing. Where else could rank tremble before courage? Jacob turned away, letting his exposed, unarmed back convey his scorn. It was a curious moment. Along with his contempt, he felt a wave of exhilaration, potent, steady. And it's at this moment that he sees Florin's mother. Immediately after this, Jacob passes the cookhouse, sees the woman in the doorway, and is offered the child. Like Faulkner's Thomas Suppin again in Absalom, Absalom, his visit to the big house produces an articulation of class difference so profound that it sets him to laughing until he comes face to face with the woman. With the ethical commitment before him, Jacob can be persuaded to take the girl as an afterthought in a series of relations grounded in inequality. He realized, and I'm quoting here, not for the first time, that only things, not bloodlines or character, separated them. End quote. Moreover, class relations here is evidenced by the myriad of references to Deortega as a feat or laced with sexual energy and gendered life. A mercy here is a singular but mysterious act, known only to the interlocutors. In any event, this mercy's significance is not reciprocated by Jacob. He does not think of that moment literally in kind or in relationship to Florin's mother, but rather as evidence of his elevated stature in the world. This elevation causes him to have fantasies of building, quote, a house that size on his own property. And again, like, a house that size on his own property. Later in the same section, we learn that Jacob, quote, did what was necessary, secured a wife, someone to help her, planted, fathered, end quote. I'm going to skip this and go into the next section. So I want you to remember this. This one thing here, swimming in horrible shoes, appeared to be about the same age as Patrician. And if she got kicked in the head by a mare, the loss would not rock Rebecca so, end quote. The death of their fifth child has rocked his otherwise capable wife, Rebecca. And so the substitute child, the enslaved, is valued, is exchanged because a loss would not rock her so. Florence figured death by mare two times as the first mare, Regina, who has a name though, Florence's mother does not, carries Varak to the Deortega plantation, bringing about her separation from her mother. And the second mare, having already killed the five-year-old Patrician, is conjured here to produce a second value for Florence. The capriciousness of the animal is utilized by Morrison to mark Florence's situation in Jacob's eyes. The proximity to the animal makes her status as chattel even more cogent. The exchange of child for slave child, the end of Varick's bloodline, the presence of the mare produces sexually potent situation. Remember, it's a horse, it's a mare, not just a horse here. If anyone's ever tried to ride a mare, they know what I'm talking about. A charged scene of sexual possibility is emphasized during Deortega's tour of, quote, the little sheds on the plantation, ostensibly to have Varick select a slave to settle Deortega's outrageous debt. As they pass the cookhouse, Jacob sees Florin's mother and says, her, that one, I'll take her. Realizing that the clothes scent which follows her is also evident in Deortega's sweat, quote, he suspected that there was more than cooking Deortega sought to lose. Like an animal, Jacob senses Deortega's weakness. In these scenes of sexual tension and transgression, we are ever reminded that diversity is also interconnectedness, that we cannot pull apart the racial elements of the novel from their embeddedness in class, that we cannot have our race in class without our sexuality too, that we cannot have our discussion about sovereignty and about freedom without thinking about the animal. As the section closes, we see Jacob remember Regina, his released mare, fondly by remarking upon the night sky, a canvas smooth and dark as Regina's hide. As he washes away, quote, the faint trace of Coon's blood, end quote. I cannot help but think about the double meaning of Coon here. In the end, his walk in the warm night air, his reflection upon the animal, brings him to the following conclusion, and I quote one more time. Now he fondled the idea of an even more satisfying enterprise. and the plan was as sweet as the sugar on which it was based. And it's at this moment that he changes his mind and starts to really get into the rum running business. The sexual satisfaction that comes from capital gain is palpable here. Jacob settles upon this plan after a conversation with patrons at Percy's Tavern, but he also settles upon this plan in the wake of another scene with another horse. On his way to his lodging, he saw a man beating a horse to its knees. Before he could open his mouth to shout, rowdy sailors pulled the man away and let him feel his own knees in the mud. Few things angered Jacob more than the brutal handling of domesticated animals. He did not know what the sailors were objecting to, but his own fury was not only because of the pain he'd inflicted on the horse, but because of the mute, unprotesting surrender glazing its eyes, end quote. Brutal handling of domesticated animals and attempts at domestication, at civilizing, at acculturation, have more in common with animal being than we might think. There are two gazes in this opening section, that of Florin's mother, who remarks at the end that she had, quote, gathered you and your brother to stand in their eyes, end quote. One could argue that the only human endeavor that matters is the ethical commitment to the other. Who can be seen because of the commitment to more than one's own life. It is clear that Florin's mother sees, recognizes, and inhabits this space called a mercy. It is also clear that Varric's own vision is skewed by the way in which Florin's is exchanged for so many things in the beginning of this section, an exchange mediated by the persistent and relentless referencing to the animal. The focus on the human in the novel is consistently interrupted by the gaze of the non-human other, which calls for sharper focus on the doers and the done to, demands a clearer perceptiveness about what freedom and sovereignty mean in the context of this new world order, whose logocentrism necessarily and repeatedly puts human at odds with animal in a kind of relentlessness that we must imagine we need to unpack.
That's okay. I just wanted to see how long it
was.
Just curious.
No, thank you so much, Sharon. No, I'm wondering about Beloved, because when you think about everything that she does with the animal in A Mercy, I'm wondering if you're interested in the way that she decides in A Mercy, of course, to go back to the 17th century, the 1600s. But in Beloved, then, when she's giving us the 19th century focus, she also gives us that focus on the animal, but it's the same in some ways, but different, right? So I'm wondering if you can think about two parts of Beloved. I'm wondering if it becomes productive to do so. The part when school teacher, of course, tells her children to line up the human and animal characteristics.
And make sure you line them up.
Right, and to make sure you line them up. And then, of course, that other part when Paul D tells Setha, you have 2 feet, not four. Right, so I'm wondering, and the reason why, just to say a little bit more, the reason why I'm thinking about it not only in terms of what she's doing with animals in both, but I guess like everybody, I'm still trying to figure out what in the world she means when she tells us that A Mercy is about that pre-race moment.
That's
probably really much more complicated than
what we're trying to talk about.
Yeah. So yeah, whatever you want to do.
And that's what, well, I feel like I can start with the second part first, because I feel like that's why I'm interested in the characterization of Lena. In order to signal, right, this kind of pre-race moment, she invents a native character, right? And I'm interested in how Lena is deployed as in the book as a figure of that moment, in particular. And so, I mean, that's part of the reason why I was interested in this. I'm not, as you can see from my reading, I'm not too enamored of what Lena. She only gets one section, right? That's actually about her. And everyone else gets at least two. Well, that's not true. Jacob, I don't think, gets another one. So she and Jacob end up having only one kind of role in Rebecca. But Florence gets several. And Florence is clearly like the central character of the novel in many ways. But to back up to Morrison, I feel like there's a lot of science. There's like a lot of attention to scientific racism. You have 2 feet, not four. Line them up. There's a lot of attention in Morrison to taxonomy, right? Taxonomy, sorry. It seems as if, if she's kind of going to this pre-racial moment, what in a sense figures belonging in a moment where race doesn't solidify things for you? And I really feel like she needs to make the animal a really productive kind of run-runner here in this novel in order to do that. And so I was interested, because of that moment, I was interested in talking about this book for the study I'm doing on perishment and human-animal distinction. Because it seems as if there's a problem of embodiment in the novel. You know, the human keeps slipping. It just constantly keeps slipping. So that's so I feel like Thomas, you know, Morrison's kind of definitely a 19th century examination where certain things have become solidified. You know, and here certain things have become solidified, so then what can we use so that we can be able to see them? And what you end up doing is use the animal in the sense of three or five stereotypes that come after, so to speak.
No, I think it's so fascinating because then of course we have this obsession, for better or worse, with this post-racial discourse and then Morrison making us get fun.
Exactly. Yeah, she drops a novel right when everybody was in their kind of like when the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, and peace and really kind of safe. I'm not gonna sing those. I was gonna sing them, I said that. It's a little too frightening. A little too late in the afternoon for that. There might be a hand going up there.
Yes, thank you very much for your talk. Because your book project, if you'll be attending, any attention to like questions about capitalism perhaps, or gaps in theology, that you speak to constitute human others that are often analyzed?
No, not really. No, I mean, I have friends. I've been working in food studies, but never actually produced work in food studies. And there are a group of us who form kind of a little collective who are interested in the visceral. And there are several people involved there who are looking at capitalism, this idea. But I'm actually teaching a course called Eating the Other. But not necessarily focused on, you know, cannibalistic aspects of food, human, animal. But thinking in a sense about how food studies has always managed not necessarily to really talk about race very much in a very productive way, right? It's always protecting its object, right? Which is the beauty of the food, right? But, you know, a flourless chocolate cake is a black beast, literally, in French. Now, if you're going to learn how to make one, you've got to travel with the nemesis to get there, right? So, but I can give you someone's name, Keila Thompson.
Tompkins,
thank you. Yeah, I knew it was wrong. Keila Tompkins is very much interested in cannibalism. He's doing some really interesting stuff. Not necessarily cannibalism, but he's really doing some really interesting stuff on the 19th century and the viscerality of eating. You know, literally, pleasuring yourself or the other by ingesting him or her. So I guess it's cannibalism, but a very different kind. And a more cool.
So I have two questions, actually. Not necessarily. First of all, you never break. I had these work, Native Science. Sam Carlo Pablo, scholar in the region of Mexico. But one of the things he points out is that it seems to me to be true as far as I can take it, is that there's no word for animal in Native language. The difference is not constructed through these oppositions. The same would go with, and I've done work on this, the nature-culture divide, which is part and parcel of that whole configuration. So I don't know how that might impact on what you're doing. So that's one point. If you look at this from a sort of native perspective, the question of the animal is not there. I mean, there are different kinds of questions. The other point is I'm kind of curious about Brunel's characterization of the colonial coming in 1871, since really the colonial moment, I think, can be dated back to the Trade and Intercourse Acts when the Congress of the United States takes control over Indian land. And certainly by Worcester v. Georgia, 1832, we have domestic nations and an oxymoronic construction of Native sovereignty. So that, the ending of the treaty arrangement between the U.S. and the tribes and the nations seems to me to be a rather late moment.
That's why I credited it to him, because I thought maybe that would call, you know, it's an interesting, because he's talking about the third space of sovereignty, I was interested in how aspects of what he's talking about in this book might actually relate to work on sovereignty, that, you know, theoretical work on sovereignty, one of the things that I've been trying to do is to find a way to have work on sovereignty and state perception actually take into consideration, like, the vast amount of work in Native Studies on that particular word and its meaning and its permutations. And because sovereign encompasses beast, it was a really kind of interesting way to talk about the animal, which is basically what the sovereignty argument is about in studies on state of exception. But when I get to the other part of the paper, obviously I'm going to talk about, you know, what it means, you know, how sovereignty is not in a sense fashioned in the same way as, you know, beast versus sovereign. In the same kind of, I would say, way which Derrida is trying to play with it. But it does bring about this manifestation of an animal as written, as imagined through colonial law, right? The ungovernability, right, of the other's body creates a state of being animal. And so it's not like a one-to-one correlation that I'm looking for. It's not necessarily a belief, right, in the existence of the category, but how the category is created and the kind of work that it does. And Morrison is utilizing that category, you know, in her, you know, through the figure of Lena. I find it very problematic.
You know, in Johnson v. McIntosh, part of Marshall's argument for dispossession of Native Americans, the taking of their land, and is the fact that they are not governable, if they're not absorbable into the polity.
It cannot literally be absorbed into the body politic.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the little quote, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to find a way for folks who have been ignoring Native work and Native studies for the better part of a decade and dealing with state exception work to think through how these various discourses actually have great relation with one another, although they might not take the same object. And so I'm not sure at the end and the final analysis whether a mercy is going to really help me get there. But it's where the project started. 5 years from now, I'm not sure what that's going to
be. I haven't read the essay yet, but you know Mark Rifkin's essay? Yeah, I haven't seen it, so I don't comment on that.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I quoted Brunelli because I wanted people to know that, you know, his stuff, not necessarily my take on where things start. But all that to say, the third space of sovereignty critique is going to be very important. And so I think it's important for scholars to really kind of take it up, talk about it, and kind of put it out there so that, you know, we can establish our own kind of readings of it in space and time.
I was wondering if you could just say a bit more about kind of the model of methods that you're trying to derive, and in particular whether you're thinking through the animal, the capacity of the animal for ethical action. And
right.
Kind of the reason I'm posing this question is that you probably know a lot of a kind of critique of kind of the Derridian Levinasian frame focusing on the gaze is that it's ultimately anthropocentric, right? It kind of reinscribes the priority of the human, the animals. Yeah, the animals deprived of the capacity for
selfish rights.
But the animal's not allowed ethical action. And so if you're interested in kind of, you know, undermining the logic of dehumanization, one needs to get outside of that kind of paradigm. And so I guess I'm wondering if that's the type of concern that you're engaging with.
I think the first concern I had when I heard this project was to try to trace the history of blackness's theoretical, but blackness in theory, not necessarily black people's per se, right? Relationship, ethical commitment to the animal. And this kind of came out of that post-Michael Vick moment, right? Where, you know, people got into the whole nature versus culture. You couldn't stand up for the animal in any way, shape, or form. You know, it made you a racist. I'm very interested in how we can't, you know, and I said, well, there's, and I started looking through the literature. And there really isn't a thought in, you know, from Fanon, Douglas, and others, that there's talk of the animal, but there's always this kind of looking away, right? Because of that vexed relationship. So that was my first opening. Then I got involved with all the, you know, of amazingly productive folks at Duke who are doing work. We're now like considered one of the places, like one of the centers for primate studies. Right? So we really, that, you know, it's really taking off. And people are doing some amateur work on the ground, which is really amazing. So the second thing I got interested in, I took a seminar with Nanji Khanna and Kathy Moody on human animal gender to talk about the place of women in this sort of relationship. And so one of the ways in which I'm thinking about this project comes from the problem philosophy of not being, you know, Derrida gets to the animal that therefore I am, all the way to the end, and it's nothing. And it's like, oh, what about that cat? And you're like, oh, oh God. You know, like, you know, you started with the cat, say something about the cat. And he's like, gone, right? So Derridian. You're like, oh, he's, what he's trying to prove is that philosophy can't do it. There's no real way to actually find the animal's agency in a philosophical tradition that is, that whose very lifeblood is bent, you know, is created from the animal's subjection to itself. Right? So I think that that's, you know, one of the things I'm interested in. And the third, to answer like that one part of your question about what is the model of ethics, I'm interested in the ethical term, but I'm interested in it through the eyes of the animal. And I'm also interested in how so many of those ethical terms don't turn on pleasure, but they turn on pain. You know, it's in that, it's in the minor league, right? Because, you know, at one point in that whole thing, you know, I love my dogs. Right? I love my dogs. What does it mean to say that? What does it mean to say that and fight them? What does it mean to love your horse and beat it through a cross-country course? Because you need to jump that fence. You know what I mean? These are the questions I'm interested in, right? And I'm interested in it from the pleasure side of the perspective, which takes into account the animals. Not just hopefully. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I was just thinking since you mentioned you're not getting there, you're gonna get there with MRC. I was wondering if people like Hurston do sort of ethnographic work at all, which picks up all of those, a lot of those questions in a different kind of way. Have any place at all in which I was just thinking because today we mentioned Tell My Horse and you just mentioned experiment about that. And then Hurston's mules all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And actually Hurston is one of the people that Spiegel quotes from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, definitely. Right. The woman from their eyes, the woman is a mule of the world as far as I can see. So she definitely, I mean, she's in that. I hadn't thought about returning to Hurston. But you know what? But I think I've got a lot of literature to kind of move through, and I'm trying to figure out whether I want this to be, you know, I've got one chapter on Pamela Liu's novel Pamela, where there are no characters, they're just characters. And I'm really interested in, you know, how do you write a novel when characters' names are Z, X, and Y, right? About human being or relationship. And so I have very different, you know, what I'm trying to do is not, usually in my work is being prescriptive, but I'm trying to say, if we opened up the question to its, you know, to the end of the standard, therefore I am, right? Where the cat is looking at you, you're still naked and not in your bathrobe yet, right? What would we find? So, but I think, you know, there could be a chapter on Hurston. Really, thank you for that. I came through Hurston in graduate school, and, well, you know, she was like, you know, my all-time number one favorite.
And I haven't been back, that works. Yeah. Well, let's thank our speaker again. Thanks, Jim.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.